Hello, I'm Kyle Willoughby. Joining me is Claire White.
Hello.
And this is Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures in Nerd Manual. We're here to discuss new nerd creations, how they were made, and explore the roots of the characters and the stories. And today we're talking about Carve the Mark, which is a new YA novel by Veronica Roth. Veronica Roth gained prominence with the Divergent series.
Mm-hmm.
And Claire will talk a little bit more about that in the rest of the show. But just a short summary of Carve the Mark. Carve the Mark is a YA science fiction slash fantasy novel set in a solar system of 9 inhabited planets. And on one of these planets, there are two cultures who hate each other. One's very warlike, the other's peaceful. Carve the Mark concerns Akos, a handsome boy from the peaceful culture, and Sierra, or Kyra, a pretty girl from the warlike culture.
I like how you include handsome and pretty.
Of course, because it's YA.
It's YA.
And spoiler alert, they fall in love, probably, if you read this book, all right? So don't be surprised. It's also important to mention that in the world of Carve the Mark, there are oracles who channel a force. It's kind of like the force from Star Wars. It's called the Current, and they have a big part in this world. And also that same current, that same force, also gives everyone in that solar system a special, unique power.
That was a really good summary, Kyle.
Thank you. I summarize with the best of them.
Yeah, there's a lot going on in this book.
There is a lot going on.
And that's
on.
Why you're on this podcast. How are you feeling, by the way?
I feel so much better. Yeah. I don't want to get into the gritty details of last week, but thank you for bearing with us, listeners. Because it would have been torture for Claire for us to be stuck in a recording together in a small space. I'm glad you feel better as well, Claire.
Yeah, I still can't hit high notes, but I'm getting there.
Well, it's good we're not doing any. This isn't the musical episode. That's next week.
Okay.
So if you can be better by then,
I'll work on it.
So Claire's going to be telling us about the production and about Veronica Roth. And are you talking? What else? YA?
Just basically Veronica Roth and the production. She's done very well for herself.
She's young.
Spoiler.
Too.
Yeah.
Yeah. She's like 27, 28, something.
28. Yeah.
And I'm going to be talking about Fates, because that's a big part of this book, and I guess I will launch into that now. So there are a lot of themes that can be potentially fleshed out in Carve the Mark. What I want to focus on specifically was the idea of fates. In Carve the Mark, there are 9 planets that make up the universe and solar system, and the fates or oracles are an integral part of the world. Each of these 9 planets have 3 oracles who will tell the future. And the oracles, they tell, like, the fates of the important families, the people in this world who, quote-unquote, matter. And so the fated families are mostly the ruling class. However, like, every now and again, there'll be a family that is fated, and it means they're gonna be important, and that happens actually in the very beginning of the book. So I want to start with some of the most fate-obsessed, or one of the most fate-obsessed civilizations, and that is the ancient Greeks. Talk about their idea of fate and where, like, that came from. Because there are some similarities between the ancient Greek morai and the oracles of Carve the Mark.
That was the first thing I thought of when they started mentioning, I mean, obviously oracles and fates. Like, oh, ancient Greece.
That and Akos, maybe it was just to my ears. I couldn't find any support of this, but to me it sounds like a Greek name. Maybe because Argos, Akos.
It has a lot of K's in it.
Yeah.
And when I see K's, I think Greek name.
So the three morai, or the three fates, as they're commonly called, were ancient Greek deities, and they were always depicted as women, and most of the time seemed to have power even over the Greek gods. So they were like, if you think about the old Hercules cartoon,
mm-hmm.
you know, the Disney one, and those three old women cutting the threads, those were the fates, those are the morai. And the gods even would have to bow to them. Except for Zeus sometimes, like sometimes Zeus could push them around, but mostly the gods were under them. And the fates' names were Clotho the Spinner, Lachesis the Apportioner, and Atropos the Inevitable. So Clotho was the one who would spin out a thread of someone's life. And Clotho was normally represented as a maiden, at least in the Greek tradition.
Not in Hercules.
Well, I'm going to mention that next, actually. So Clotho in the Greek tradition was a maiden. She spins out the thread of someone's life. Lachesis would measure that thread, and she was a matron, you know, like a motherly mm-hmm. figure, and determine its length. And Atropos would choose the manner of the thread's death and would cut the thread. And that one was a crone. And Atropos was the one that people, like, feared the most or didn't like the most. Now, when you look at the Roman version of these fates, they're all crones. And they're all hated or feared.
Now that makes sense in Hercules.
Yeah, so the ones you see in the animated Hercules are more along the Roman tradition. And the Greeks had respect for the fates and, you know, thought of them as deities. And they feared Atropos. But the Romans were just like, no, they're all assholes. And they
these old women who don't want me to have a good time.
Exactly. These old mean women who decide our fate and they cut the thread and they're mean. So those are the Morai. I want to move on to a more specific oracle that actually existed for a very long time and I think is super fascinating. And you could talk about this oracle for days and days and days, and there's tons of great documentaries on her. The Oracle at Delphi. And since prophecy being such a big part of the book, I thought it was especially relevant to talk about her because she's probably the most famous oracle ever to exist, and she was probably the most powerful woman of the ancient world.
She shows up in a lot of ancient Greek tales and legends, right?
Yeah, ancient Greek, ancient Roman, you even see her in some Phoenician stuff because she existed in that Mediterranean area where there were all these different cultures, you know, stacked on top of each other. Now, Delphi is still a city in Greece, but for almost 2,000 years, it served as a holy site, which eventually became one of the most important parts of the world for the Greeks and the Romans and anyone in the Mediterranean, honestly. Archaeological evidence suggests that people started worshiping at Delphi in 1600 BC. There was a fissure in the ground because there's a fault line that runs through it, and gases would come out, and it would cause a kind of rapturous trance.
And I would worship that too.
Exactly. Well, around 1400 BC, the people who were living there built a temple over that fissure. And the temple was dedicated to Gaia, who is kind of the Greek earth mother goddess. And priestesses would go into that temple, into the basement where that fissure was, and they would inhale the fumes coming from the earth and go into these trances.
And see the future.
And see the future, or commune with the goddess, originally is what it was. Is you would go in there and the priestesses would commune with the goddess and you could ask.
And it was only priestesses?
It was only priestesses. It was just chicks. What would happen is the priestess would go down, inhale, commune with the goddess, and then a priest would come and the priestess would talk to that priest and that priest would interpret her words, write them down, and give them to whoever wanted to, like, ask a question of the goddess.
Do you know why it became just women?
I'm actually not sure. I assume it had to do with Gaia being the mother goddess of Greece, and that's originally what that temple was dedicated to.
I guess the priest is interpreting it, but it just sounds like a lot of power that you're giving women. And from reading some about the ancient world, it always feels like women didn't have a lot of power.
When you even look past the ancient world into, like, when humans were first getting together, the goddess tradition is one of the oldest traditions on Earth. So it does make sense. And this was in 1400 BC that the temple was built, but they were worshiping there before. So it's possible that, you know,
the tradition evolved.
That Gaia, being the Earth Mother goddess, called for a woman to commune with. Now, it's funny you mention that, though, because it does change. The Oracle of Delphi changes, and what that temple's dedication to changes. And that's when it's weird that it's a goddess. But I guess maybe the goddesses were, or not that it's a goddess, that it's a priestess. And I guess that's maybe the priestesses were so entrenched in that area that they couldn't get rid of them. But in the 7th, 8th, or 9th century, they're not sure, BC, the shrine and Oracle of Delphi switched from being dedicated to Gaia to being dedicated to Apollo.
That's how I know that's what I think of when I think of the Oracle.
Yeah, it's the Oracle of Apollo. And after that point, the priestess wouldn't commune with Gaia, she would commune with Apollo.
But it was still a priestess.
It was still a priestess, and it was still a priest interpreting
Didn't Apollo usually sleep with the priestesses? Wasn't that a thing?
There was a thing where originally it was only maidens were allowed to be to be oracles, but they actually found that they were getting harassed a little bit too much by the people who came to the oracle
Apollo.
And by the priests and by Apollo maybe. So it was switched to a matrons. You had to be a mother.
Okay.
You had to be a slightly older woman. Not necessarily crone, but slightly older.
Not a crone.
Not a crone. You gotta,
but not
you know,
a maiden.
Yeah, you can't be a 16-year-old. You gotta, you know. Have had some living, but you also can't be too old. Gotta still be cute. Now, according to the Apollo legend, there was a great python that resided at Delphi, and Apollo and it fought, and after Apollo slayed it, he tossed it into that fissure, which, you know, gas was still coming up. And the vapor that would float up through it and allow priestesses to commune with Apollo was the decaying corpse of the python. And for this reason, the Oracle at Delphi became known as the Pythia. And that's if you're trying to look up more about Delphi, you should search for the Pythia, because that was her name. Now, the Pythia and Delphi would become famous throughout the ancient world and would be consulted by the most powerful figures of the time for about 1,000 years.
Yeah, wasn't it a thing that the Greeks wouldn't go to war until they got the okay?
Until they got the okay from the oracle.
Yeah.
Not all the time, but often. And Delphi was protected. You could not attack Delphi. Delphi was sacred. No one was supposed to go into Delphi. In fact, at one point, a Greek city-state did try and invade Delphi, and Philip of Macedon, who was Alexander the Great's father, put a coalition together and was like, no, no one touches Delphi.
Wow, and it was mostly respected.
Yeah, and it was mostly respected because the oracle was so powerful. Now, her prophecies were very often shrouded in enigma and very vague and open to interpretation. But for 1,000 years, she was respected. Like, she was calling it, and it was in at least a sense coming true.
Prophecies are always vague. It's like when you read your horoscope.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But she was still maintained that respect, and people loved her. And a lot of her prophecies were like kind of, you know, life lessons, or, you know, it's like
fortune cookie.
Yeah, like a fortune cookie. And I want to talk about two of her prophecies, which I thought were pretty cool, which are a little less known, which I'd never heard, because she's got some famous ones. But in 67 AD, the Roman Emperor Nero came to Pythia for a prophecy because he wanted to know what his rule was going to be like. How long was he going to rule? How successful he was going to be?
And Nero was one of the more brutal emperors?
Yeah, he was kind of a psycho. He's famous for playing the violin as Rome burned, is what the you know, yeah. How the story goes.
I know the name, so he did something.
So he did something, yeah. He definitely
because there's
had
a lot of Roman emperors you don't know the name of.
He had a notable rule. but he was just 30 years old when he went to the Oracle. And in coming to power in Rome, he had killed his own mother. So
that's
part of his story. And he goes to the Oracle to be like, hey, how's my rule going to be? Is it going to be great? And the Oracle says to Nero, your presence here outrages the god you seek. Go back, matricide. The number 73 marks the hour of your downfall.
That's ballsy.
Well, she paid for it. So Nero was pissed that the Oracle would take this tone with him and talk about his downfall. And Nero had the Pythia either burned or buried alive, reports conflict.
Oh.
But he also thought at the same time that was a good prophecy. He's like, oh, I'm going to rule until I'm 73 years old.
So I'm having you burned. But thank you.
Yeah, it's going to be awesome. When in reality, Nero only reigned for 12 more years before he was overthrown in a revolt led by a Roman named Galba, who was 73 years old when he started the revolt.
Oh.
So, you know, that's oracle thing. It's that good oracle thing.
Those fumes, man.
They'll tell the future. And this is the last prophecy I want to talk about with the Oracle, because it concerns someone who shares a name with one of the main characters in our story, Carve the Mark.
Ooh.
Cyra is how Veronica Roth says her name, but I say it Kyra, and I think she's wrong. But we'll get to that in the opinion section.
Yeah, you
I know
say
she
your
wrote
own
the book.
Character wrong.
She wrote the book, but she's wrong pronouncing her character's name. That's a douchey thing to say. I don't actually mean that. Anyway, this happened in 560 BC. Croesus of Lydia was asking if his monarchy would last long, and Lydia was a powerful city-state in around modern-day Turkey. And he went to the Pythia to be like, hey, you know, is my rule going to last long? I'm thinking about invading Persia. What should I do? And the Pythia says, whenever a mule shall become sovereign king of the Medians, and the Medians were under the Persians, the Lydian delicate foot, flee by the stone-strewn Hermus, flee, and think not to stand fast, nor shame to be chicken-hearted. So what she's essentially saying is that if a mule is king of the Medes, then you should run away. Like, don't do anything. And Croesus thought, like, ain't no mule king of the Medes. Like, I could totally attack them. My rule's going to last forever. My monarchy is assured. And he had forgotten that Cyrus, or Kyrus the Great, king of the Medes and the Persians, was Median on his mother's side and Persian on his father's side, thus a mule.
Ooh.
Because mules are half horse, half donkey.
Yeah, that is not a good prophecy.
Yeah, I know, right?
Not helpful.
Exactly, not helpful. And so Croesus invaded Persia and got messed up. And Cyrus the Great
really spent some time with that prophecy.
Cyrus the Great steamrolled right over him. And he's a funny figure to mention because I don't know if this was on purpose, but the main character in Carve the Mark is Cyra, or Kyra, which is the female version of that name. And Cyrus the Great actually has prophecy, like a bunch of prophecies associated with him, where his father was told he would be the emperor of the world, and his father was jealous of that. So you know, tried to have him killed, and he was taken away as a baby, but he survived, and he comes back and ends up taking over the Persian Empire and conquering the known world at the time.
I can see some parallels.
Can you see some parallels?
A few parallels, yeah.
You know, they're both fated. They both have the same name. I thought it was kind of interesting, and I wonder if it was on purpose. I'd like, if I ever meet Veronica Roth, I'm going to ask her that.
Okay. Good for you.
But that's what I have to say about the Pythia and the Oracle and Fates and concerning Carve the Mark. Yeah. What do you have for us, Claire?
Something just as deep. Just kidding. It's really interesting, though. So I'm going to start with talking about Veronica Roth because she has done very well for herself. I'm going to start off by saying she's 28 right now.
Yeah, that is incredible.
It's going to get more incredible. Just you wait. Her first book, if you haven't heard of it, you've probably been living under a rock, is called Divergent. It's about a society segregated by moral virtues and a girl who doesn't fit in. Now, this book she wrote over the course of 40 days when she wasn't doing homework during her senior year at Northwestern.
That's insane.
Yeah, just
that's so cool.
Good use of your time. So that same year, she took it to a writer's conference, and she got an agent right away at that writer's conference.
Wow.
In April of that year, it sold in 4 days to the first editor who finished reading it. And they picked up the trilogy, not just one book. So it was kind of sold. It was billed as a trilogy, and they didn't just say, like, oh, we'll see how this does.
And then.
Yeah. No, they picked it all up.
That's a whirlwind experience.
Yeah, when you're 21, 22.
Yeah.
And then the film rights sold to Summit Entertainment before the book was even released. And Summit are the same people who made Twilight.
Mm.
Now, I'm not saying this is anything against her writing, but a lot of credit for her really early success there is given to the book's premise. So in 2010, when this was all happening, The Hunger Games was really becoming a thing. 2010 is right in between the release of the second and third installments of The Hunger Games trilogy, the books, not the movies.
Okay.
And publishers were looking for the next big YA title. And also, this was right after the Twilight craze had happened. And I completely forgot about the Twilight craze, and I was reading this.
How can you forget?
I don't know. I just blocked it out.
Team Jacob forever.
Oh. I don't even know enough about it to not pick a team, Kyle, so good for you. But there was a huge backlash, and I remember this, against fragile YA heroines like Bella Swan from Twilight. And Divergent has this heroine, Triss, who is a tough fighter and much more in the vein of Katniss Everdeen from The Hunger Games. So Divergent was published in May 2011, and it debuted at number 6 and then spent 11 consecutive weeks on the New York Times Children's Bestseller list.
That's really, really, really good.
For your debut novel when you're 22, 23?
Yeah, and the fact that it was picked up to become a movie immediately is awesome.
Yeah, so. It does happen with a lot of YA titles.
You just buy the rights.
Yeah, and it doesn't mean the movie's going to get made.
That's true.
Insurgent, which is the sequel to Divergent, debuted at number 1 a year later. And then the third book, Allegiant, became the most pre-ordered book ever issued by HarperCollins, which is a huge publishing house.
Did you read any of those books, Claire, or no?
No, I've seen the first Divergent movie.
Yeah.
And people like it. It's been something that's been recommended to me before, but I never actually sat down and read it.
I like Shailene Woodley, but I've never seen the
Divergent Yeah, you would like movie. Shailene Woodley.
She kind of looks like my girlfriend.
Yeah, and she's a hippie.
And she's a hippie. Yeah.
So the first movie, Divergent movie, came out in 2014, and two more were made. And now there's talks of making the last, like the second half of the last book, a TV show or something. But Shailene Woodley it won't sign on if it's going to be a TV show, or it isn't included in her contract and she's out.
Yeah,
that's a whole other can of worms.
Yeah.
But the movies so far have grossed $743 million, which is pretty good.
Yeah, it doesn't sound too shabby.
As far as Divergent goes, the book series, 30 million copies had sold by 2015. I'm sure that's more now. And 2015 was a big deal for Veronica Roth because she was put on the Forbes Celebrity 100 list. She was ranked number 95, which out of 100 doesn't sound amazing, but out of the whole world sounds really amazing.
What's the Forbes Celebrity 100 list?
I think it's like the most influential 100 celebrities.
Okay.
If you think about like all the celebrities in the world and all the people in the world, Veronica Roth.
That's pretty good.
Is on that list. And YA author too.
Yeah, yeah.
In 2015, according to Forbes, she was the world's third highest earning author. And this is behind James Patterson, who you might know from your airport bookstore.
Yep.
And John Green, who is another YA author. He wrote The Fault in Our Stars and Paper Towns. I didn't realize he was so big. Actually, your girlfriend has worked in high schools before, and she was telling me, like, oh, people love John Green.
Yeah, yeah, the kids love John Green. Yeah. They love those sad teenage romances.
There's something very appealing about that. But Veronica Roth in 2015 had grossed $25 million. In 2016, last year, she dropped to the ninth highest earning author with $10 million.
What other authors were on that list, out of curiosity?
J.K. Rowling.
Makes sense.
Dan Brown.
Dan Brown, of course.
Yeah. Susan Collins wrote The Hunger Games. I don't think she's on that list anymore, but she was.
I bet you she was.
Mostly, what's her name? Danielle Steele.
Oh.
Names that you've definitely heard
of.
Stephen King.
Yeah.
And now I'm going to talk a little bit about Veronica Roth and her writing process, especially for this book. She's been writing fiction, science fiction, actually, since this, not just fiction, science fiction.
I know, be specific, man.
Since the sixth grade. And apparently she's been toying with this idea for this story since she was working on the Divergent series. She was very inspired, she said in an interview, when she was in Romania with her husband, who was studying there, and she realized that people there had limited resources, and an example she gave is that they would add water heaters to buildings rather than replace them like we might in America.
Okay.
And she saw how their priorities were different than hers, and she wanted to write about cultures with different priorities.
It's funny that you mentioned Romania. I didn't know that, but in thinking about it, the Shotet Empire, which is like the warlike empire on the planet, does resemble a bit of Romania in the 70s under Ceausescu. It was like this dictator that really controlled information.
A militarized state.
A militarized state. So that's funny that you mentioned that.
Yeah, that could totally be related.
Yeah.
At first, she thought this was going to be a fantasy story, and then it gravitated to science fiction. And she says she always tends to gravitate to science fiction, divergent science fiction, too.
Yeah.
She also said she was inspired by several of her friends who experienced chronic pain. And then they had doctors who didn't take them seriously. Then it turned out that they had endometriosis, which I looked up, and basically it causes a lining in your pelvic organs, especially in the ovaries. And it tends to cause a lot of pain because it develops cysts, which sounds horrible.
Yeah, that does not sound like a good time.
And she thought a lot about how pain takes over your life, it limits you, and how hard it can be to find people who take you seriously. And I completely believe that.
Yeah.
And that Kyra, or how do you say it?
Kyra.
didn't start out as an important character, but then she felt very urgent to Roth because of these women in her life, and then she became one of the main characters.
She didn't start as an important character. I would say she is the main character.
Akos was who this story was originally based on, and who she was originally writing about.
Huh, that's funny.
This is just fun. Where Akos is from, how would we pronounce it? You had a...
Thuvhezit?
Yeah. It's basically a winter country.
A winter wonderland.
Yes. And it was inspired by a winter wonderland, which is Chicago, where she lives in the winter.
I think it's generous to put wonderland on the end of Chicago.
Chicago in the winter. I do too. And she also says that her early success has left her feeling under more pressure for her next project, which is totally understandable. If your first book does that well,
then
your second novel, your second story, you would feel that you'd have to match
live up to that or improve, ideally improve, you know?
Yeah, and she felt that she had to walk a tightrope of making a unique universe and also maintaining a sense of familiarity to bring Divergent fans back.
Yeah, sticking to her guns.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to talk a little bit about her process, how she writes, especially she likes to listen to music to get in the zone. And the music depends on what she's writing. Like for Akost, she listened to country or folk music because he comes from a country folksy background. And she only listened to male voices. And for Kyra, she listened to female voices who were angsty like Sia.
Really?
Yeah.
I would have thought like metal. She listened to Slayer for Sierra or Kyra.
Next time. Maybe for the next book, she can take your advice, Kyle. And she thought it was very important for her readers, young teenage girls, to show that her main characters are able to bounce back in the midst of difficulty and for them to know that they are strong enough to deal with anything that comes at them. Thought that was a nice message.
Yeah, that is.
Here's a little bit about the stats. First of all, Harper is promoting Carve the Mark as a tale for fans of Divergent and Star Wars, which with the current and
the current quote unquote being like the Force. That's what every review I read of it mentioned. The current, they compared the current to the Force.
Yeah, how can you not? It is number 9 on the USA Today's best-selling books list, number 1 on the New York Times hardcover young adult bestseller list. And it has solidly average reviews.
Solidly average.
Solidly average. So, Kyle, what did you think?
I don't like YA normally anyway. It's not something that I gravitate towards. There have been a few exceptions, one of which happened on this podcast. But it's never something I really want to read. It's more your wheelhouse. And reading Carve the Mark, I was not that into it at all. There are parts of it I like and there are parts of it I don't like, but I had a really hard time finishing this book.
Yeah.
I'll be honest, especially towards the end. I think it dragged a lot at the end. What about you?
So I do like YA. And I picked this book because I hadn't read any of Veronica Roth, but she was just such a big deal. She is such a big deal in the YA world because of Divergent that I thought it would be a really interesting thing to cover and one of the top selling authors in the world. And yeah, I was disappointed too because for a YA, I should, even if I don't love it, I should just be able to zip through it and
eat it up in
a day. And it took me a long time to get through. It just got a little bit jumbled, especially at the end, like you were saying. I do think the ideas that she has are super cool. Like when the book started and she's introducing the world and the current gift and the oracle.
Yeah, and like then the planets and stuff.
Yeah, I was there. Yeah. I can be there. I'm ready to get down with this. But I don't know. Maybe it's her early success, and I believe she's going to get better as a writer, but it just felt like there were a lot of holes in the plot. There were a lot of things that were unexplained that didn't make sense later in the book, and maybe I just missed it because I do tend to kind of zip through these things. I don't know. I was a little disappointed.
I read every word of books. Like, that's what I do as I make sure to read every word. And people ask, like, well, just skim it. You don't read the whole thing. You just skim it. But for this, I read every word, and there were definitely holes and things that didn't make sense. And I was like, wait a minute. Why are they doing that? So why would this character do this? What was your favorite part of the book, Claire?
Oh, the world. I thought that the current, and I wished that she had gone more into the current gifts. And I thought that was so cool, like how everyone gets this gift, and it's a blessing and a curse. Like Sira, the main character, or one of the main characters, she can cause pain to anyone,
yeah.
But also it causes her to be in a ton of pain
constantly,
and yeah, and the idea that everyone has these gifts and how it affects other people and the people around them and their lives was so interesting and cool and different too.
Yeah.
Not something that you always read. What was your favorite part, Kyle?
I definitely like the world. I think the universe and stuff, anything that's set in space or has a space aspect to it, I'm already there. I'm like, oh yeah, space, of course. That makes sense to me. And the planets and stuff were cool, and the current was cool. I liked Sira, or Kyra is what I'm going to call her. And here's why, is because in the book, and this is maybe an example of one of those things that didn't quite make sense. In the book, Sira, as the author calls her, is Shotet, which is a people who have a really harsh language. And it's even mentioned that Akos, who is the other main character who's not from Shotet, has a Shotet name because of that hard K, like that hard K sound, and that's a hallmark of their
that
language.
Greek name.
That Greek name. So I was like, oh, okay, so clearly it's Kyra. And then in interviews, it was Sira. And I was like, wait a minute. That didn't make sense. Also, the fact that Cyrus the Great is actually, his real name was Kyrus the Great, the Persian emperor who I mentioned before.
Right, who she might not have based it on.
I know. But still, even with the language that was in the book itself, like not lining up that well, I don't know, it's a really small nitpicky thing, but it bothered me.
Yeah, I do think that's a testament, though, to, like, the world building as a whole, which sounds really mean. But it was like it hadn't been completely thought out.
Yeah, it wasn't fleshed out.
And even in interviews that I watched of her, and she seems really cool and nice and smart, it just felt that she's like, I forget what the question was, but they're asking her about USA Today was asking her about a certain part of the book. And she's like, oh, you know, I haven't completely worked that out yet.
That always scares me.
Yeah. And some authors can get away with that.
Yeah.
But I think it was obvious in this that it hadn't been completely thought out.
Completely fleshed out.
And then there's this thing we were talking about called current blades. But I didn't understand what made them special.
Yeah. Yeah. If they were like supposed to be lightsabers, but they're not really quite lightsabers. And Akos uses just a regular knife.
Yeah.
And if that's worse than a current blade, there's no guns really that, I mean, there's spaceships that have blasters, but none of the like people walking around on the planet have guns. And for me, science fiction is like something I really, really love. And part of my love for science fiction is going into like the technology, what they have. And even, it doesn't even need to be super in depth. Like when we did Binti, it wasn't like super technically in depth, but there were cool aspects to it. Like, oh, they're flying through space on a creature that they grew. That's a living creature that has air, you know, and pressurized pockets inside of it. And I was like, well, that's really cool. And it kind of goes into that a little bit and you can see it. And in this, wasn't quite sure what any of the ships or anything looked like or how they functioned. And at one point, there's just this one resistance guy whose ship is stealth. And that's yeah. it's just like thrown in there as like, oh, we can do this because it's stealth. And it's
and
like,
they just
oh, good,
happen to have a stealth ship on hand.
Yeah, just this guy who like lives by himself in like the poor part of town.
Has a stealth ship, yeah. I think that's also my biggest problem with the book is like I don't mind inconsistencies, and if it's a good riveting story, especially with YA, which is my guilty pleasure, like yeah, I'll follow through and I'm there. But I'm also comparing it to Six of Crows and Crooked Kingdom, which might be completely unfair because it's one of the best YA novels I've ever read. And we did it in October last year and it blew my mind. But I'm comparing it to that. And in Carve the Mark, I wasn't invested in the characters and their relationships because some of the characters, I didn't understand what made them different from other characters. Like one character is regal, but we only know she's regal because it says she's regal.
Yeah.
You know, but within the text, it was never proven to me that she was regal.
Yeah.
Things like that really annoyed me.
I had a problem with the plot conveniences.
Yeah, that bugged me
that
too.
Just like, just to, for the sake of the plot, to keep the story going forward, there were these like giant, I felt, kind of leaps of faith.
Stealth ships.
Perfect example. We need to save this one character. How can we do it? Oh, well, we got a stealth ship. We've had it this whole time. It's like, oh, okay. Maybe this would have been convenient earlier. I'm glad it's here now. And there were just parts of the plot or pivotal moments in the plot seemed to not be explained or poorly explained. And so it just felt random, like really convenient that all these things fell into place.
And with another author or in a different story, even if things are convenient, you might believe it because it felt earned. Because everything else has made so much sense up to here that, yes, this could be convenient and just be here. And that feels right.
Yeah. When the characters catch a break, you're like, yes, they caught a break. Things are going good for them. Mm-hmm. You know, it's
when
not
there's
just
a stealth ship, you totally believe that stealth ship would be there because you've believed everything else till now. And if there's a stealth ship there, you believe it had been placed there because of whatever reason. But it makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. And I hate to keep going back to Leigh Bardugo and Six of Crows and Crooked Kingdoms. I don't like YA. I don't really read YA. But those were such good books. And everything seemed like really meticulously thought out and planned. And all the pieces of those books fell into place perfectly. So when I read Carve the Mark, it was a bit of a disappointment because it didn't seem to do that very well at all. Thank you all so much for listening. Once again, I'm Kyle Willoughby.
And I'm Claire White.
And we are Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures in Nerd Manual. Feel free to contact us on our website at dsrapodcast.com, and we would love it if you could rate and review us on iTunes. You can find the show on Twitter at dsrapodcast. I can be found on Twitter at klex303, that's K-L-E-X-303.
I can be found at Along With Claire, that's C-L-A-I-R-E.
And you can find our producer James at James Fowey Jr. That's James Fowey, F-O-U-H-E-Y-J-R. You can learn more about the Pythia and Veronica Roth on our Facebook page, where we're going to list some of our sources for our show notes.
And we'd love to hear what you think of Carve the Mark if you've read it. Are we just off?
Yeah, I don't know. I kind of felt like a jerk, but
I know I
didn't
like
it.
I feel bad about trashing the book.
Anyway, back to our normal scheduled programming of credits and titles. Our producer, who was fated to push a podcast up a hill in perpetuity and only to have that podcast roll back down the hill at the end of the day, is James Foey. Our logo was done by Patty Hyland, and I'm pretty sure she served a small stint as the Pythia back in the 80s. She doesn't like to talk about it as much, though. And our theme was done by Pete Rowan, who is maybe fated? I don't know.
We don't know.
Once again, this is Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures in Nerd Manual. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next week.